Verulam Sports.
Hello and welcome to the Verulam Sport Podcast. Every week, the team behind the award-winning Radio Verulam Sports Show will provide you with the most relevant news from the local and regional sporting scenes, whilst keeping you in the picture with national and international bulletins from the world of sport. There will be topical debates, regular interviews from local talent, and chats with those big-name guests that are a mainstay of Verulam Sport. As always, this is your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So, check out Verulam Sport across social media and get involved. For now, prepare yourself for this week's action-packed Verulam Sport Podcast. Hello and welcome again to Verulam Sport Podcasting. And this week, I'm sure you're well aware, the team and I have been debating, discussing, dissecting the greatest sporting movies and documentaries. Now, tell you what, we are supremely lucky right now to be joined on the line by a man who is more learned than our team in this regard, a professional documentary maker, produced some absolute stellar work. It is John McKenna. How are you doing, John?
I'm good, Tony. Thank you. Thanks very much. I hope you're okay too.
Strange odd time, as I'm sure we are all aware, but it's just got to adapt and evolve. That's the nature of our world at this time, I think. But likewise, you're keeping well in this challenging time.
Yeah, we're doing okay, thanks. All well with the family and seeing a lot of the kids, which is great. So yeah, can't complain.
Well, I know you've got family duties a bit later on, so I'm massively grateful for your time just now, John. Just quickly before we dissect your stellar career, which has got some really supreme work, some of which I've been lucky enough to witness and see, want to get your take just generally. What's your favourite non-John McKenna associated sporting movie or documentary?
It's a very good question. I was thinking about this obviously before coming on, and which would be my number one. And I think it's When We Were Kings. Muhammad Ali.
96 Oscar winner. It's phenomenal, isn't it?
Yeah. It's amazing. And I suppose it shows what's possible with documentary. It shows what's possible with archive. Mm-hmm. And it shows what's possible with an unbelievable lead character. I think it pips. So there's a reason, because I think that's my favourite when in terms of archive-led, I suppose. And then certainly in the way we do stuff, there's two ways of documentaries being led. One is led by archive and one is led by capturing a moment in time, so observational documentary. And my favourite of that, which came second in my thoughts before this call, is the Graham Taylor England manager documentary, which is amazing for different reasons, because that just shows how powerful it can be when you are capturing something that's going on live properly, and letting the moment be the star rather than the archive be the star. So that's my 1-2.
It's a lovely 1-2 combination then. I love the lead, which was the Ali When We Were Kings. I just think it's one of those. I mean, there are certain people, and I'm going to drill into a few stars that you've captured in the art of documentary in your career, but there are certain people, aren't they, who are just larger than life, whose story, it's almost something like if you were to pitch it as a Hollywood movie, they'd laugh you out of the building. It's just ridiculous. The Zaire moment, the wonderful rope-a-dope tactic, everything about that. And as you say, the likes of Thomas Hauser as a talking head, Spike Lee, and again, the footage of all the kind of, how do they call it, the black festival that was going on with B.B. King, etc. It's a fabulous, again, award-winning movie. I haven't seen the Graham Taylor one, but fascinated to just quickly get your just a bit of a line on that as to why we should check out that Taylor movie.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, I think, I can't remember whether it was BBC or ITV. I can't remember, but it's a you know, it's not a cinema documentary. It's a British TV documentary. It's and it was following Graham Taylor and the England team when they failed to qualify for Euro.
Would it be 94 World Cup? Maybe.
No, it wasn't 84. was it, England got to 88, didn't they? So it was 80. I can't remember. There you go. I can't remember which tournament. It was 94 World Cup that we didn't go to. In USA. Of course it was. And they were in the England camp. They were. I suppose it's like maybe the one thing you've seen that's the closest to it is living with the Lions. If you've ever seen that, the rugby one, it was like that. So essentially, it was like that, but for football. And it had a real fly on the wall style. And they had a radio mic on Graham Taylor during the games when England lost to Holland and England lost to Sweden, was it? Yes, Brolin, wasn't it, I think? Brolin Darlene was a famous commentary from Brian Moore. I haven't seen it for years and years, so my memory's a bit hazy. But it had a radio mic and a camera on Taylor, and that was it. That was it. And that, honestly, that was as simple as that. And they were there for press conferences and some team talks. And it's a famous, Taylor said, "Do I not like that?" The phrase that became a TV show. And it's just amazing. And I'd never met Graham Taylor. And I worked for ITV for years, but a lot of my colleagues knew him very well. And they said he was just a lovely, lovely, lovely man. You know, when he died, the sort of feeling that came out around it was amazing. And it was, you know, I didn't know him, so I had no personal affiliation to him. But you just watched the emotion, the vulnerability. It was like watching a man be broken by the pressure of the job, really. And this England lose this game, and there's a really bad refereeing decision in it. And Taylor goes over and has this conversation with the linesman. "Excuse me, tell your boss at full time that he's just cost me my job. Thanks very much." And, you know, walks back off. And oh my, it's gorgeous filmmaking. It actually made my job, our jobs, harder for about 20 years, because after it, football clubs went, "We're never letting that happen again." because Taylor became, you know, he was famously, they put a turnip on the front of the
newspaper. I remember that well.
He became almost a laughing stock. Obviously, England didn't go through, but also the documentary didn't help him. But I don't think. But in terms of showing what's possible when you get access, it's amazing. It's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant film.
Tell you what, certainly got that on my radar, and I'll be checking that out.
Yeah.
I'm so amazed by your career, though. I mean, some great, great movies. I want to touch on momentarily another England manager that you have worked at least closely from the archive perspective with, Bobby Robson. A great movie. Was something we dissected on Brom Sports the other day, More Than a Manager. But just quickly, again, we were talking about with the When We Were Kings, the archive element, and also these supreme characters. Mm-hmm. And one of those who certainly fits that character is Brian Clough. Just tell us a little bit about your work on the phenomenal Clough documentary.
That was a long time ago. That was 2009. So there you go, 11 years ago. What an amazing character and incredible archive. And we went, obviously, when we made it, Brian was had passed away before that. We were able to. I do a lot of work, as you know, with Gabriel Clark, who's my sort of co-founder in our business, and is a writer, director, and a journalist. And so, with Gabriel, we approached the family and got the family on board, and the family then spoke about Brian, which is brilliant. And then having the family meant on board means that when you're going out to try and get the supporting cast that you want for the film, it makes it more achievable, because you can, you know, say that the family are backing this film and they know that you're going to do it in a, I suppose, it's not a puff piece, but it's a sympathetic or intelligent way. It's not, you know, you're not looking for scandal, you're not looking for headline, you're looking to do a proper study of the man. And so,
there's such a character, as we're going to discuss, but there was lots of things from Barbara Clough herself and family who were very nonplussed about the Damned United and the movie that subsequently came out about that. So I must say it must have been a little bit challenging maybe to get their buy-in. But obviously, once you've got it and they get the chance to really tell the authentic tale of Brian, I guess that was quite a powerful piece of this amazing documentary.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. You know, you're probably... your memories might be better than mine on this, because I sort of remember I'd forgotten about that. But you're right. That's what was happening. The Damn United, the film was being made as we were making the documentary, and the book had been out a few years. Mm-hmm. And the book, you know, David Peace, wasn't it, that wrote the book? And yeah. I really loved the book, you know, as a piece of fiction. And he wrote a few, didn't he? He had the Red Riding trilogy, and which I really loved his books, and I'd really sort of, you know, enjoyed the Damn United. But the family were really upset by it because that's their dad, that's their husband, they portrayed him as a you know, it is a piece of fiction, and the fiction portrayed Brian as a from memory, and it's a long time, 12 years since I've read it, but a lot of drinking and a lot of swearing and a lot of you know, aggression and a lot of, you know, and the book, because the book was going into his mind in moments and turmoil and all that type of thing. And yeah, I can remember, I seem to remember that Barbara was really upset by it, and like, because, and the big thing was that Brian never swore. I remember her saying that he just didn't swear, and in the book it was full of expletives, and that's really upset her. And so actually, I suppose that in a way made it, in terms of filmmaking process, they wanted to put across their Brian, and they knew him better than anybody else, obviously. And so they wanted to be part of our documentary. They really did. They wanted that. It's funny, isn't it? It's like you look back and you go, things you do at certain stages. And at that point, in 2009... I was still at ITV. I left ITV in 2009. I can't remember. I think that was maybe one of the last things I did before I left. And with Gabriel, obviously. And yeah, you look back at that and think, if we'd have made that now, we'd have gone much bigger with it. You know, just an ITV documentary. We'd have tried to make it for the cinema, and we'd have tried to. And I think it would have had a very, very good shot because of the charisma of the lead actor, who was amazing.
I mean, he really is. I mean, I don't think that those accomplishments in the modern era, what he did with Derby, what he did with Forest, provincial clubs, to take them to the league titles, many occasions, European back-to-back with Forest. I mean, that era, and what he writ large over that era was absolutely astonishing. But again, just his charisma. They don't make that anymore. I think the nearest analogue would be maybe a Jose Mourinho. But for me, Cluffy is almost unique. And I genuinely, I know you look back on it and almost think, my goodness me, we could have done even better with this. I still think it stands the test of time. I think as an authentic portrayal of this larger-than-life character, it's a wonderful work of art, to be fair.
Yeah. I was really pleased with it. We were really pleased with it. And it's, you know, it led to then... we made a motorsport documentary after that, and then the Fight of the Lives after that. So there's the biggest three documentaries we made at ITV were those three. And that Brian and Clough was almost like the first one that was, I think, showed that, I suppose, actually, obviously we enjoyed doing it, but it was a case of actually we can do this to a level that's really good. But then, you know, that having the archive is so immense that, I mean, there's one scene that I remember in it, that was a big thing in the film as well, the Damn United drama film as well, which was Brian with Don Revy in the Yorkshire TV studio.
Yes, after he'd just been
sacked by Leeds, and that whatever, however long that piece of television is literally sums up the charisma of the guy, but B, the intelligence of the guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because he just and his understanding of the camera. Because he owned Don Revy, who was about 20 years older than him, 15 years older than him, you know, the most successful manager in the country. And I remember Brian, he's saying to him, he gets Revy to sort of say what he wants him to say and then says, good lad, to him. It is
so powerful. And you know what?
Yeah,
The guy who actually hosted that, he had the privilege of kind of almost being the mediator between these two.
Austin Mitchell.
He described it as this, and I don't think he can do any better. He said, it was like magic from the moment they came in. And, you know, again, I think that really encapsulates it.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Cinema and documentary making are magical. There's no question about it, and you are therefore a magician, sir. So I'm going to just put this to you. Tell me a little bit about the 68th Cannes Film Festival premiered, and only one of two British films to be there as an official selection for the 2015 Cannes Film Festival. Steve McQueen, another icon, another man who will festoon many students' rooms, I think, in some iconic imagery. The Man and Le Mans, 2015. Tell you what, I really would love to get an insight into here, John, is just doing a little bit of prep on this. Almost you have to be a bit of an investigative journalist and a PI when you do this documentary stuff. A late night call to an editor in LA the day before filming, I think, gave you a bit of an inside skinny as to where to find more archive footage. Can you fill us in there?
Yeah. So Steve McQueen adorns my wall in this office as well. The poster with him giving the V's to everybody who does a Zoom call with me, Tony, like you. It was amazing. Obviously, that was the first time we. So going back to the story, I'll briefly summarise where we got to in your question. So we made three documentaries, bigger documentaries at ITV. We made a few more as well, Joe Calzaghe and a few other ones, building to Clough. And we made a motorsport documentary in 2010 about James Hunt and Barry Sheen called When Playboys Rule the World. It's about this hot summer of 1976 when they were both world champions. But it was also about what the sports stars were like in the 70s compared to the sports stars today. And Stirling Moss made an amazing quote in the film, who died sadly a week or so ago, and said, "In our day, we'd win a race and we'd go off and party. And today, they win a race and they thank Vodafone." And that sums up what the documentary we were making. And from that, we made it with an executive producer called Andrew Marriott, who is a motorsport aficionado, has worked in motorsport since, I don't know, year dot. He was ITV's equivalent to Murray Walker back in the 80s, 90s. And a lovely, lovely guy. And I'm still working with him now. And developing a big, hopefully a film that's going to come start. We're going to start in the next year or so with Andrew, as well, a motorsport film. So Andrew came to us with this idea of Steve McQueen and his making of Le Mans, this remarkable story of the superstar and his passion for sport and motor racing, and how he literally nearly destroyed his life, his career, other people's lives, everything, trying to make this film. I read a few books about it, and Andrew said, at that point in time, we were making stuff for ITV and TV, let's see if ITV want it. And I saw that and was like, we've got to try and make this as a film. We've got it. I mean, it's Steve McQueen. We've got to try.
Absolutely.
We've got to try. Why not? Let's give it a go. And that was literally how it started. It was like, let's see what we can do. And so we managed to, we went across to LA and we met Chad McQueen in the house that Steve had on Malibu overlooking the Pacific. Ridiculous. We made a trailer of what we thought this film would be, which was, really good. I thought we played that to Chad, and so with Andrew's credentials of motorsport, and Chad and Andrew were able to talk about cars. Chad's obsessed about cars. I wasn't able to offer as much as Andrew in that regard. And Chad was in. The family were in. So it's like, oh, man, we've got a family. This is amazing. Right, okay. Then we had to raise the finance, and I had a fortuitous conversation with a friend of a friend who is a huge motorsport fan, and he was in. He was like, I'm gonna back this financially, and so we managed to get the finance from a few people, and we got the money, and it's like, well, this is happening. And before you knew it, we were making this film, and it was self-funded, and on you go. And as you say, it ended up at the Cannes Film Festival, which was amazing, incredible. But yes, so we started making this film, thinking, well, we knew that the film existed. We knew there was a documentary, behind the scenes documentary that existed. And I contacted the guy who'd made that, and he had all that, some rushes, extra, et cetera, in his garage on film. So that we knew we had a pot of archive that was good.
Yeah.
However, I'm getting to the story. You're asking me. My wife says I go around the houses too much. There you go.
You build the picture. You build the
room. That's what I say to her, Tony. Yeah. We knew that McQueen had shot this film, and there was rumours that there was like a million feet of film of Russia,
right,
because he'd become obsessed. The story is in the film, if you've seen it or if you've not seen it, that McQueen just wanted to capture true racing on film, and he didn't care about the story. He didn't want him as the lead actor who fell in love with an actress and they drove off into the sunset. He didn't want the Hollywood script. He wanted to get under the skin of this sport where people at that point in time, 1970, 69, 70, were genuinely risking their lives every time.
For sure.
And often losing their lives. And he wanted to understand or put across to the audience to help them understand why people risked their lives for this pursuit. That was the film McQueen was trying to capture. Hollywood wanted the romantic ending storyline through that. McQueen did not. And that ended up being the battle that ended why the film exploded in many ways. Mm-hmm. They went over budget. They were overshot. They were painting leaves green because it was becoming autumn, and McQueen was just filming cars, filming. That's all he wanted to do. And so, where is all this stuff? So that was the quest. And we had an archive producer called Richard Wiseman, who is the motorsport archive producer. He is what he doesn't know. I don't think exists. So he was like I don't know. Rooting around everywhere. And so we were trying to find these rushes, and we'd been told by everybody they didn't exist. They'd been destroyed. The studio had fallen out of McQueen. They'd incinerated them. No chance. They're gone. Then we started to do some of the interviews, and one of the guys, the exec producer, who's one of our interviews, said, you should try this company in New Jersey, because that's where the film was finished. So it was like, okay, amazing, amazing, amazing. So we tried that. The guy who owned the lockup, whatever it was on a yacht in Australia for a month, off Australia. So we had to wait for him to come back. He's the only person with a key, obviously, which was on his key ring on a yacht off Australia. So we had to wait for him to come back. He came back, opened the lockup. Now it's not there. So we'd given up. Anyway, yeah. we were casting our interviews, and we were speaking to editors and assistant producers and producers trying to see who was going to be in the film. Mm-hmm. We spoke to this guy who wasn't in the film, but he said, the last place that all the rushes would be, and we're asking everybody about this question. He said the last place it would be this place in LA, because that's where the final dialogue editing was. So they'd have taken all the rushes there in case they needed them. So Richard, I was in Russia. I was working in a job. I was working in the Sochi Winter Olympics. I was in Russia. Richard was in London. They were in LA, and we had this three-way phone call where this guy said, yeah, okay. He said, he gave Richard short shrift. Yeah, we'll look, yeah. Put the phone down. Richard knew that he didn't take it seriously. Fortunately, we just announced the film, so there's a big article in the Hollywood Reporter about the film. We sent him that link. He obviously then went, actually, these guys are serious. Mm-hmm. Went and had a look, called us back, and then this three-way phone call via Russia, UK, and LA, in which he said, yeah, I've just looked under the soundstage, and there's however many boxes full of film reels with Le Mans written on the side. And it was like, oh my God, we found
the Holy Grail almost.
And we did. And there was too much to transfer. And unfortunately, the studio then went, we told the studio and thought we're going to get it all.
Yeah.
The studio went, thanks very much for finding that. It's going to be about $10,000 a minute for you to use it, and you've got to transfer it. And it was like, no!
Listen to this story, and you've got to give us, throw a man a bone. But what a story. I absolutely love that. Do you know, there's a documentary about the documentary making of that movie right there.
Yeah, yeah. I think we've already gone down that rabbit hole. We want to do that again. No,
fabulous stuff. But another fabulous piece of your work, and we analysed it a little bit this week in Vermsport Podcasting, is Bobby Robson, More Than a Manager. Again, almost analoguing with Taylor, a man who was harangued by the media in his role as England manager. But what a career. What really struck me about this documentary, which I truly, truly love, is the amount of love from so many different high caliber people from all walks of life. My man, Jose, Sir Alex Ferguson, Paul Gascoigne, Gary Lineker, of course, Pep Guardiola. It's just phenomenal, the range of those footballing great and good who simply adored Bobby. It must have been a really kind of humbling to gather that as you worked towards this wonderful, wonderful documentary.
It was amazing. And I think it took us by surprise a little bit. As you say, the names that were in it, Ronaldo, R9, Ronaldo, the Brazilian Ronaldo, Pep, Jose. We obviously set out to make the film. Gabriel was convinced that we should do it as a cinema documentary.
Yep.
Honestly, I questioned it. I was like, is it that level? And I was proven wrong, which is often the case. And because of that. And we sat down on day one and wrote a list of who, in an ideal world, we would get in the film. And that was you know, between Gabriel and I, that was probably maybe, I had to handle a lot of that and contact these people. We obviously met the family, and again, the family were on, and Mark Robson, who's in the film, Bobby's son, was a lovely, lovely guy, and we got to know him really well. And then Lady Elsie, we went and met, went out for a pub lunch with Lady Elsie and Mark, and told them about the film, and so the family were in, which is great, which obviously then helped. You can go and speak to people and say, listen, we're doing this with the family, and it's going to be, you know, the definitive film about Bobby's life. So that's your ask. Will you be part of this? It was difficult to get to some of them because they're busy and they get lots of requests, and often your request is then put in with the myriad of other requests, and it's like it doesn't get the right attention for them to realize what you're asking. It's not,
I've got a small insight into that type of experience, but
it's difficult, isn't it? It's difficult to get the right question to the right person, and so there was a few routes through. But everybody, we had a list on the whiteboard, which was a ridiculous list of, if we got half of that list, it would be amazing, and we got the lot.
Tremendous.
We were having to say no to people. Vyas Boas was out in China at the time, and there's an amazing story about Vyas Boas and Bobby. It's like the best story that anyone would tell. It never made the film because we didn't do the interview. It's like, you know, he was a 14-year-old kid, lived in the same flats as Bobby, and that story alone we wanted in the film. But he was in China, and it ended up being, because everybody came in, we just didn't have the time or the space. The love for him is just extraordinary, and I think that came shining through in the film. I think was that this man was just a special man. He was a special man. He was a lovely man. I met him a couple of times. I was really lucky to meet him a couple of times. And I think like everybody else that met him, I didn't know him, but I met him, and I came away from both meetings with him thinking he's just great. He's great.
Yeah. Some people do just have that charisma again, that charm, then that make people feel at ease, don't they? But if you look again, there's that different array of psychologies that he was working with. I mean, Gaza, okay, and a Gary Lineker, they are worlds apart, aren't they, in terms of their psyche, their mentality. And he was able to tap into them on their level to get the best out of their given talent. And that, I think, is the art of management. Not that I'm a manager, but that my outsider looking in. But Bobby seriously had that art down, and it comes across through this wonderful documentary. If you haven't seen this, I urge you to find out, to get involved with Bobby Robson, More Than a Manager. It's a supreme, supreme work of art. Yeah, but a quick point to you on this. All over Netflix right now. Final quick point on Bobby Robson, More Than a Manager, which again, I just adore. One thing which is even more special, I think, it's not what it's all about, but it's just, again, reflection of the overall ethos of the man and your own kind of way of working. Great work in partnership with the Sir Bobby Robson Foundation. Just tell us a little bit about that. And again, remind us, I know it's on Netflix. How else can we get access to this phenomenal movie?
We partnered with the Bobby Robson Foundation, which is an incredible foundation that has raised, I mean, I can't remember what the figure was when we made the film, and obviously the figure will be higher now because that was a couple of years ago. It was raising an extraordinary amount of money for cancer research, based out of Newcastle. We partnered with the film the charity because we wanted to try and do more than just, you know, interview the family and make a film. We wanted to try and make a film that hopefully made money, and then part of that money would go back to the foundation, which is what we've done and the way we've set up. So that was important to us, and also because Bobby setting the foundation up and the charity up was he called it his greatest team. It was the last team he assembled, and he called it his greatest team. And then obviously he died of cancer, and having fought through cancer four times, I think, during his career. So that storyline was a key part of the film, and it felt the right thing to do and a good thing to do to partner with the charity. So that's what we did. The film is on Netflix until the end of this year, but you can also buy it or download it on iTunes and Amazon and all those places, which is, you know, it's Father's Day this weekend, so it's a good Father's Day day gift, maybe.
Great work there. Great work. Yeah, but seriously, it is a great work of art, this one. Seriously, it is. It's just a supreme character, wonderfully captured on film. It's a phenomenal effort. And I urge you again, maybe treat your father, treat yourself, get involved with Bobby Robson more than a manager. It's phenomenal. John, I could talk to you all day. There's so much of you've done. I loved and was so privileged to be at the St. Albans Odyssey Cinema for the launch of The Edge, which again is sport and drama told through the narratives of the people who lived that England journey. It's a sensational journey. Just very quickly, remind us about The Edge, because again, I could talk to you about it all day, but I'm aware of time now.
Oh, it's okay. It's fine. The Edge, we made The Edge last summer. We wanted to make that, we wanted to bring that out around the extraordinary cricketing summer, which it turned out to be truly ridiculously extraordinary, which we didn't know when we were making it, of 2019. And so The Edge is a film about England cricket, Andrew Strauss, Kevin Peterson, James Anderson, under Andy Flower, and the England cricket team that came from, I think, number 7 in the world, and a bit of a shambles of a side through to they set out to become number 1 in the world, and they achieved that. And it was a study of how you become the best in sport. And again, with that, or similar with a lot of our films, and you know, there's a lot of stories that can be told, and there's a lot of amazing stories that you could potentially choose to tell. But so you have to have some form of a criteria for the ones you decide to do. And that one was brought to us by the director, Barney Douglas. And I think the thing for me with that was the questions we asked at the start, and we asked at the start most of our sort of films is there anything that people won't know? What are we bringing that's new to the table here? The audience will go, wow, I didn't know that. And that's amazing. Is there an amazing archive that's unseen? And Barney, he'd been the sort of media producer, TV producer throughout that period. So he was filming with the players behind the scenes on all sorts of occasions as they were building this side and building towards being one. Amazing archive. And the thing about cricket for me was I didn't play to a very good level, but I used to play when I was a boy. And I used to play a lot more football and a lot more rugby than cricket. And I got to play much bigger games in the other sports than I'd ever did in cricket. But whenever I went out to bat in cricket, I was more nervous than any game of any other sport.
When you just objectively think about it, right, you've got like less than a second to react to this ball coming at you at oftentimes 85, 90 miles an hour. You know what? There's a fine line between genius and insanity. And a lot of insane people would be in asylums for doing things less mental than that, I think.
It's an extraordinary sport, and that was the thing for me. It was like, can we bring out the ludicrous nature of this most individual of team sports that you know makes, you know, from my experience, made me more nervous than anything else. So what is it about this ridiculous sport? So then it becomes the film becomes more than just for cricket fans. It's like, let's try and understand this film. But actually, the film never took that path, because when we started doing the interviews, or Barney started doing the interviews, because he knew the players really well, they opened up to him in a way that I don't think they would have done to an independent person. And so when the first two or three interviews came in, it became apparent that this film is not so much going to be a study of cricket. It's going to be a study of the mental toll it takes to be the best. And that's what the film became. And again, it wasn't what we set out for it to be, but that then became the film. And again, that's where, you know, Barney did a really, really amazing job to visualise the sport and the what the players went through. And again, with Gabriel and his journalism and his journalist who wrote the film with Barney, it was trying to then focus in on that and structure the film around that. And we went back out, we went out and did more interviews with Andy Flower, especially when the film was coming together. We needed, because of the way the film was shaping up, we needed then to speak to certain people and go, actually, we didn't ask this question. So what do you now, how do you now reflect on this when this is revealed? And so we went back out to tie the film up. So it was a different process to normal. Normally you got your interview once and you structure from that. But actually we went back, I think we went to Andy Farr 3 times in the end. And he was really generous about it all and really you know.
And again, the word that I would use is honest. Honest. Everybody that came through, that comes through, Andy Flowers, who kind of masterminded this almost military-esque operation, which achieved the result intended, i.e. to rise from the doldrums to the top. But then the ripple effect, the pressures on the people is so intensive, aligned to the natural pressure of test match cricket and a high elite level sport anyway. And you see that come through with the likes of Jonathan Trott, Matty Prior. And it is, again, such an honest, powerful work of art that as much as I love cricket, as much as I love sport and documentaries, what you've really captured there, John, is the human condition. Because everybody can relate to this on some kind of level, whether you're pursuing whatever it might be or you're just generally existing. We face massive pressures on a day-by-day basis. And how we react to that is how we progress in anything. And that narrative arc, so honestly, so authentically delivered by the real players in the piece, sensational. And again, a reflection of the fact they trusted you and the team.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Barney, the trust with Barney was amazing. Jonathan Trott was amazing in the film and what he was willing to say. And what I found really interesting about Trott, especially in that process, was he obviously did quite a lot of interviews when the film came out. And I think you've summed it up well. It's just, that's the human condition. That's what he went through. And so people were saying to him, you know, in these interviews, you know, oh my gosh, it was amazing what you said. It was amazing what you went through. And he was like, really matter of fact about it. It was like, that's just what happened. That's the truth. He just literally told his truth. And it was amazing, because I don't think many sports people will ever do that and be that honest. And Jonathan trusted Barney and the process of the film enough to, as you saw in the film, to get in a water tank in full cricket gear and trust that this is not something ridiculous and is going to make me look stupid.
Indeed.
You know, so that in itself, I suppose, sums up the trust that you say that was achieved.
And one thing I'd like to believe is that people watching this, and it was super successful, will, you know, have that open ability, that now encouragement to, if you are suffering in any way, shape or form, and the mental stresses, and it's going to be relative to each and every individual, whatever is causing that, reach out, open up. And I think what I'd like to believe also is that sports people like Matthew Prior and others, and documentaries such as this, will help in that sporting context, where there is almost the default to machismo. So I think in many regards, you've actually created a work there which it will cause, not exclusively, but help towards massive societal changes. And just quickly, your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I you know, that's a bigger theme, I think, than I can really comment on. But if that's the case, that's amazing. You know, we wanted to make a film when we realised where the players were allowing us to go.
Yep.
Then obviously we wanted to treat it sensitively and make a film that was an important film, and that was our aim. You know, it was something that people that work in these areas and understand these areas and people that have experienced these things will watch and take something from. And you know, a film for more than just cricket fans was what we set out to make at the start.
And truly achieved that goal. It's wonderful. Again, well worth investigating. Get that in your life. John, for me, it's an honour and a privilege to enjoy your company. Before I let you go, just briefly, I know you are working always towards massive, exciting projects. Just quickly, what can we look forward to from the team at Noah Media?
The team at Noah Media are very busy in a very challenging time. Obviously, we're working remotely at the moment, but we're able to do a bit of filming again now, socially distant, but we're able to complete one film. We've got a couple of projects, unfortunately, that are paused, a couple of TV projects that are big series for various broadcasters that are paused at the moment, but we've got a Jack Charlton film that is in production and that is now back in edit, and there's 3 or 4 days of filming still to go, but we're going to start to push towards a completion and hopefully release in cinemas and wherever else we can get it from end of November.
I can barely wait for that one.
Yeah, it's going to be great. It's again a film with much more than than maybe we thought when we started. And it's following that a really exciting trajectory in terms of the story. So that's coming in November, and we're having some really good conversations with broadcast partners in Ireland and the UK. So hopefully that will get a big wide release towards the end of the year. That's the big one that's coming next, I suppose. We've got two other films that I can't tell you the names because we've not announced them yet, but we will be announcing them for 2021 that are really exciting. One is a big, huge American sporting star that is in production, and another one is a big themed film that it's sport, but it's not really a sport film, a documentary. It's more an adventure documentary, really. Both of those are in production and for 2021, and we've just finished a couple of pieces for we do a lot of work with big sporting federations like FIFA and UEFA and others, and so we've just finished a big a documentary about the 1970 Brazil World Cup for FIFA, which FIFA are distributing that around their partners, and which is really, really lovely. It's lovely. One of our young directors has made that, and it's his first directing role, and he's knocked it out of the park, which is, yeah, it's great. And then we're just finishing off a gymnastics observational doc. So we talked about the archive doc, that's the FIFA one. We just finished a gymnastics observational doc, where a series where we've been following three gymnasts from around the world, one in Russia, one in China, and one in America. And it's supposed to be towards Tokyo this summer, but obviously that's now not happened. So we're just finishing that series off, and then we're going to pick it up again, excuse me, with another episode around the Olympics next year. So that's the work that's been going on in the company at the moment, in Noah Media, as you say. Yeah.
Tell you what, massively exciting times. And always when it comes to the Noah Media efforts, you're guaranteed an emblem of high quality, human-related, big issue types work. So I'm already super enthused. John, it's been phenomenal, as always, to enjoy your company, to get your insights into the amazing world that you lead. I would like to wish you and family all the best at this challenging time, and I look forward to catching up with you in the near future. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, my man. Thanks again.
Thanks, Tony. Always great to speak. Thank you.